A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars: Dark Lord, The Rise of Darth Vader by James Luceno. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Part 1. The Outer Rim Sieges. Mercana. Final Hours of the Clone Wars. Dropping into swirling clouds conjured by Mercana's weather stations, Rhone Shrine was reminded of meditation sessions his former master had guided him through. No matter how fixed Shrine had been on touching the Force, his mind's eye had offered little more than an eddying whiteness. Years later, when he had become more adept at silencing thought and immersing himself in the light, visual fragments would emerge from that colorless void, pieces to a puzzle that would gradually assemble themselves and resolve. Not in any conscious way, though frequently assuring him that his actions in the world were in accord with the will of the Force. Frequently, but not always. When he veered from the course in which the Force had set him, the familiar white would once again be stirred by powerful currents, sometimes shot through with red, as if he were lifting his closed eyes to the glare of a midday sun. Red mottled white was what he saw as he fell deeper into Mercana's atmosphere, scored to reverberating thunder, the rush of the wind, a welter of muffled voices. He was standing closest to the sliding door that normally sealed the troop bay of a Republic gunship, launched moments earlier from the forward hold of the Gallant, a Victory-class Star Destroyer, harried by Vulture and Droid Tri-Fighters, and awaiting High Command's word to commence its own descent through Mercana's artificial ceiling. Beside and behind Shrine stood a platoon of clone troopers, helmets fitting snugly over their heads, blasters cradled in their arms, utility belts slung with ammo magazines, talking among themselves the way seasoned warriors often did before battle. Acrid odors infiltrated the cramped space, along with the roar of the aft engines, the starboard one stuttering somewhat, the gunship as battered as the troopers and crew it carried into conflict. Even at an altitude of only 400 meters above sea level, the cloud cover remained dense. The fact that Shrine could barely see his hand in front of his face didn't surprise him. This was still the war, after all, and he had grown accustomed these past 3 years to not seeing where he was going. Nat Sem, his former master, used to tell him that the goal of the meditative exercises was to see clear through the swirling whiteness to the other side. That what Shrine saw was only the shadowy expanse separating him from full contact with the Force. Shrine had to learn to ignore the clouds, as it were. When he had learned to do that, to look through them to the radiant expanse beyond, he would be a master. Pessimistic by nature, Shrine's reaction had been, not in this lifetime. Mercana's lathered clouds finally began to thin, until they merely veiled the planet's wrinkled landscape and frothing sea. A sudden burst of brilliant light drew Shrine's attention to the sky. What he took for an exploding gunship might have been a newborn star. And for a moment, the world tipped out of balance, then righted itself just as abruptly. A circle of clarity opened in the clouds, a perforation in the veil, and Shrine gazed on verdant forest so profoundly green he could almost taste it. Valiant combatants scurried through the underbrush, and sleek ships soared through the canopy. In the midst of it all, a lone figure stretched out his hand, tearing aside a curtain black as night. Shrine knew he had stepped out of time into some truth beyond reckoning. A vision of the end of the war, perhaps, or of time itself. Whichever, the effect of it comforted him that he was indeed where he was supposed to be. That despite the depth to which the war had caused him to become fixed on death and destruction, he was still tethered to the Force and serving it in his own limited way. Then, as if intent on foiling him, the thin clouds quickly conspired to conceal what had been revealed. Closing the portal, an errant current had opened, and Shrine was back where he started, with gusts of superheated air tugging at the sleeves and cowl of his brown robe.
"The Korovar have done a good job with their weather machines,"
a speaker-enhanced voice said into his left ear.
"Whipped up one brute of a sky. We used the same tactic on Perrin Minor. Drew the Seps into fabricated clouds and blew them to the back of beyond."
Shrine laughed without merriment.
"Good to see you can still appreciate the little things, Commander."
"What else is there, General?"
Shrine couldn't make out the expression on the face behind the tinted T-visor. But he knew that shared face as well as anyone else who fought in the war. Commander of the 32nd Air Combat Wing, the clone officer had somewhere along the line acquired the name Salvo, and the sobriquet fit him like a gauntlet.
"Alliance weapons should have us in target lock by now,"
Salvo said, as the gunship continued to descend. Other assault ships were also punching through the cloud cover, only to be greeted by flocks of incoming missiles. Struck by direct hits, 2, 4, then 5 craft were blown apart, flaming fuselages and mangled troopers plummeting into the churning scarlet waves of Mirkana Bay. In one of the 50-odd gunships that were racing down the well, 3 other Jedi were going into battle, Master Saris Lorne among them. Stretching out with the Force, Shrine found them, faint echoes confirming that all 3 were still alive. He clamped his right hand on one of the slide door's view slots as the pilots threw their unwieldy charge into a hard bank, narrowly evading a pair of hailfire missiles. Gunners ensconced in the gunship's armature-mounted turrets opened up with blasters as flights of Mankvim interceptors swarmed up to engage the Republic force. The anti-laser aerosols scattered the blaster beams, but dozens of the Separatist craft succumbed to missiles spewed from the gunship's top-mounted mass-drive launchers.
"High Command should have granted our request to bombard from orbit,"
Salvo said.
"The idea is to take the city, Commander, not vaporize it," Shrine said loudly.
Mirkana had already been granted weeks to surrender, but the Republic ultimatum had expired.
"Palpatine's policy for winning the hearts and minds of Separatist populations might not make good military sense, but it makes good political sense."
Salvo stared at him from behind his visor.
"We're not interested in politics."
Shrine laughed shortly.
"Neither were the Jedi."
"Why fight if you weren't bred for it?"
"To serve what remains of the Republic."
Shrine's brief green vision of the war's end returned, and he adopted a rueful grin.
"Dooku's dead. Grievous is being hunted down. If it means anything, I suspect it'll be over soon."
"The war, or our standing shoulder to shoulder?"
"The war, Commander."
"What becomes of the Jedi, then?"
"We'll do what we have always done. Follow the Force."
"And the Grand Army?"
Shrine regarded him.
"Help us preserve the peace."
Mirkana City was visible now, climbing into steep hills that rose from a long crescent of shoreline, the sheen of overlapping particle shields dulled by the gray underbelly of the clouds. Shrine caught a fleeting glimpse of the Argente Tower before the gunship dropped to the crests of the frothing waves and altered course, pointing its blunt nose toward the stacked skyline and slaloming through warheads fired from weapons emplacements that lined the shore. In a class with Maegido, Ma'unalinst, and Nymoidia, Mirkana was not a conquered planet, but a host world, home to former senator and Separatist council member Passel Argente, and headquarters of the Corporate Alliance. Mirkana's dealmakers and litigators, tended to by armies of household droids and private security guards, had fashioned a hedonistic domain of towering office buildings, luxurious apartment complexes, exclusive med centers, and swank shopping malls, casinos, and nightclubs. Arranged like the spokes of a wheel, 4 10-kilometer-long bridges linked the city to an enormous offshore landing platform. Hexagonal in shape and supported on thick columns anchored in the seabed, the platform was the prize the Republic needed to secure before a full assault could be mounted. For that to happen, the Grand Army needed to penetrate the defensive umbrellas and take out the generators that sustained them. But with nearly all rooftop and repulsor lift landing platforms shielded, Mirkana's arc of black sand beach was the only place where the gunships could insert their payloads of clone troopers and Jedi.
Shrine was gazing at the landing platform when he felt someone begin to edge between him and Commander Salvo, set on getting a better look through the open hatch. Even before he saw the head full of long black curls, he knew it was Oli Starstone. Planting his left hand firmly on top of her head, he propelled her back into the troop bay. "If you're determined to make yourself a target, Padawan, at least wait until we hit the beach." Rubbing her head, the petite, blue-eyed young woman glanced over her shoulder at the tall female Jedi standing behind her. "You see, Master? He does care." "Despite all evidence to the contrary," the female Jedi said. "I only meant that it'll be easier for me to bury you in the sand," Shrine said. Starstone scowled, folded her arms across her chest, and swung away from both of them. Bol Shatak threw Shrine a look of mild reprimand. The raised cowl of her black robe hit her short vestigial horns. An Iridonian Zabrak, she was nothing if not tolerant, and had never taken Shrine to task for his irascible behavior or interfered with his teasing relationship with her Padawan, who had joined Shatak in the Mirkana system only a standard week earlier, arriving with Master Lorne and two Jedi Knights. The demands of the Outer Rim sieges had drawn so many Jedi from Coruscant that the temple was practically deserted. Until recently, Shrine too had had a Padawan learner. For the Jedi's benefit, the gunship pilot announced that they were closing on the jump site.
"Weapons check,"
Salvo said to the platoon.
"Gas and packs."
As the troop bay filled with the sound of activating weapons, Shatak placed her hand on Starstone's quivering shoulder.
"Use your unease to sharpen your senses, Padawan."
"I will, Master. The Force will be with you."
"We're all dying,"
Salvo told the troopers.
"Promise yourselves you'll be the last to go."
Access panels opened in the ceiling, dropping more than a dozen polyplast cables to within reach of the troopers.
"Secure to lines,"
Salvo said.
"Room for three more, General,"
he added, while armored, body-gloved hands took tight hold of the cables. Calculating that the jump wouldn't exceed 10 meters, Shrine shook his head at Salvo.
"No need. We'll see you below."
Unexpectedly, the gunship gained altitude as it approached the shoreline, then pulled up short of the beach as if being reined in. Repulsor lifts engaged, the gunship hovered. At the same time, hundreds of Separatist battle droids marched onto the beach, firing their blasters in unison. The intercom squawked and the pilot said,
"Droid Buster away!"
A concussion feedback weapon, the Droid Buster, detonated at 5 meters above ground zero, flattening every droid within a radius of 50 meters. Similar explosions underscored the ingress of a dozen other gunships.
"Where were these weapons 3 years ago?"
one of the troopers asked Salvo.
"Progress,"
the commander said.
"All of a sudden, we're winning the war in a week."
The gunship hovered lower, and Shrine leapt into the air. Using the Force to oversee his fall, he landed in a crouch on the compacted sand, as did Shatak and Starstone, if less expertly. Salvo and the clone troopers followed, descending one-handed on individual cables, triggering their rifles as they slid to the beach. When the final trooper was on the ground, the gunship lifted its nose and began to veer away from shore. Up and down the beach, the same scenario was playing out. With projectiles and blaster bolts whizzing past their heads, the Jedi and troopers scurried forward, hunkering down behind a bulkhead that braced a ribbon of highway coursing between the beach and the near vertical cliffs beyond. Through an opening in the bulkhead hastened the four members of a commando team with a captive in tow. Unlike the troopers, the commandos wore gray shells of Katarn-class armor and carried heftier weapons. The enemy combatant they'd captured wore a long robe and tasseled headcloth, but lacked the sallow complexion, horizontal facial markings, and cranial horns characteristic of the Corivar. Like their fellow separatists, the Nymoidians, Passel Argente's species had no taste for warfare, but felt no compunction about employing the best mercenaries credits could buy. The burly commando squad leader went immediately to Salvo.
"Ion team, Commander. Attached to the 22nd out of Boz Pity."
Turning slightly in Shrine's direction, the commando nodded his helmeted head.
"Welcome to Mirkana, General Shrine."
Shrine's dark brows beetled. The voice is familiar, he began.
The face even more so,
the commando completed. The joke was almost 3 years old, but still in use among the clone troopers and between them and the Jedi.
Climber,
the commando said, providing his sobriquet.
We fought together on Deco Nymoidia.
Shrine clapped the commando on the shoulder.
Good to see you again, Climber. Even here.
Climber lifted his helmet faceplate to the gray sky.
A good day for fighting, General.
I'll take your word for it, Shrine said.
Make your report, squad leader.
Salvo interrupted. Climber turned to the commander.
The Korovar are evacuating the city, but taking their sweet time about it. They've a lot more faith in these energy shields than they should have.
He beckoned the captive forward and spun him roughly to face Salvo.
Meet Idis, human under the Korovar trappings. Distinguished member of the Vibroblade Brigade.
A mercenary band,
Bolshatak explained to Starstone.
We caught him with his trousers down,
Climber continued,
and persuaded him to share what he knows about the shoreline defenses. He was kind enough to provide the location of the landing platform shield generator.
The commando indicated a tall, tapered edifice farther down the beach.
Just north of the first bridge, near the marina. The generator's installed 2 floors below ground level. We may have to take out the whole building to get to it.
Salvo signaled to his comlink specialist.
Relay the building coordinates to Gallant Gunnery.
Wait on that, Shrine said quickly. Targeting the building poses too great a risk to the bridges. We need them intact if we're going to move vehicles into the city. Salvo considered it briefly.
A surgical strike, then?
Shrine shook his head no. There's another reason for discretion. That building is a med center. Or at least it was the last time I was here. Salvo looked at Climber for confirmation.
The General's correct, Commander. It's still a med center.
Salvo shifted his gaze to Shrine.
An enemy med center, General.
Shrine compressed his lips and nodded.
Even at this point in the war, patients are considered non-combatants. Remember what I said about hearts and minds, Commander.
He glanced at the mercenary.
Is the shield generator accessible from street level?
Depends on how skilled you are.
Shrine looked at Climber.
Not a problem,
the commando said. Salvo didn't like it.
I strongly recommend that we leave this to the Gallant.
Shrine regarded him.
What's the matter, Commander? We're not killing the Separatists in sufficient numbers?
In sufficient numbers, General. Just not quickly enough.
The Gallant is still holding at 50 kilometers,
Shatak said in a conciliatory tone.
There's time to recon the building.
Salvo demonstrated his displeasure with a shrug of indifference.
It's your funeral if you're wrong.
That's neither here nor there, Shrine said. We'll rendezvous with you at Rally Point Orek Bacta. If we don't turn up by the time the Gallant arrives, feed them the building's coordinates.
You can count on it, sir.
Shrine knew the place about as well as anyone, but he let the commandos take the point. Dodging blaster fire from battle droids and roving bands of mercenaries, and trusting that the captive fighter had known better than to steer them wrong, the three Jedi followed the 4 special ops troopers on a circuitous course through the switchbacked streets. Shortly, the Allied team reached the approach avenues of the southernmost of the quartet of bridges that joined the city and the landing platform. Encountering no resistance at the med center, they infiltrated the building's soaring atrium. The particle-filled air buzzed with current from the shield generator, raising the hairs on the back of Shrine's neck. The place looked and felt deserted, but Shrine sent Shatak, Starstone, and 2 of the commandos to reconnoiter the upper floors, just in case. Still trusting to the captive's intelligence, Shrine, Climber, and Ion Team's explosives specialist negotiated a warren of faintly lighted corridors that led to a turbo lift the captive had promised would drop them into the shield generator room.
Sir, I didn't want to say anything in front of General Shatak,
Climber said as they were descending.
But it's not often you find a Jedi and a commander at odds about tactics.
Shrine knew that to be true.
Commander Salvo has good instincts.
What he lacks is patience. Outside the anti-grav shaft, the deafening hum of the generator made it almost impossible to communicate without relying on comlinks. Prizing his from a pouch on his utility belt, Shrine set it to the frequency Clymer and his Spec 3 used to communicate with each other through their helmet links. Warily, the three of them made their way down an unlighted hallway and ultimately onto a shaky gantry that overlooked the generator room. Macrobinoculars lowered over his tinted visor, Clymer scanned the area.
"I count 12 sentries," he told Shrine through the comlink. "Add 3 core of our technicians on the far side of the generator,"
the Spec 3 said from his position. Even without macrobinoculars, Shrine could see that the majority of the guards were mercenaries, humans and humanoids, armed with blaster rifles and vibroblades, the brigade's signature weapon. Cranial horns, a symbol of status, especially among members of Mercana's elite, identified the Korovar among the group. 3 Trade Federation battle droids completed the contingent.
"Generator's too well protected for us to be covert," Clymer said. "Excuse me for saying so, but maybe Commander Salvo was right about letting the Gallant handle this."
"As I said, he has good instincts." Clymer flashed a series of hand gestures at his munitions expert. Then the three of them began to work their way down to the greasy floor. Surrendering thought and emotion, Shrine settled into the Force. Taking out the guards was merely something that needed to be done. At Clymer's signal, he and the Spec 3 dropped 4 of the sentries with precisely aimed blaster bolts, then juked into return fire to deal with those who were still standing. As tenuous as his contact with the Force sometimes was, Shrine was still a master with a sword, and almost 30 years of training had honed his instincts and turned his body into an instrument of tremendous speed and power. The Force guided him into areas of greatest threat, the blue blade of his lightsaber cleaving the thick air, deflecting fire, severing limbs. Moments expanded, allowing him to perceive each individual energy bolt, each flick of a vibroblade. Unfaltering intention gave him ample time to see to every danger and to carry out his task. His opponents fell to his clean slashes, even one of the droids, whose melted circuitry raised an ozone reek. One mercenary whimpered as he fell backward, air rasping through a hole in his chest, blood leaking from vessels that hadn't been cauterized by the blade's passing. Another, Shrine was forced to decapitate. He sensed Clymer and the Spec 3 to either side of him meeting with similar success, the sibilant sound of their weapons punctuating the shield generator's ceaseless hum. A droid burst apart, flinging shrapnel. With that, the fight began to wind down. Shrine's breathing and heartbeat were loud in his ears, but under control. Thought, however, intruded on his vigilance, and he lowered his guard before he should have. The shivering blade of a mercenary's knife barely missed him. Spinning on his heel, he swept his attacker's feet out from under him, and in so doing, rid the human of his left foot. The Merc howled, his eyes going wide at the sight, and he lashed out with both hands, inadvertently knocking the lightsaber from Shrine's grip and sending it skittering across the floor. Some distance away, Clymer had been set upon by a battle droid and 2 mercenaries. The droid had been taken out, but its sparking shell had collapsed on top of Clymer, pinning his right hand and blaster rifle, and the pair of Mercs were preparing to finish him off. Clymer managed to hold one of his would-be killers at bay with well-placed kicks, even while he dodged a blaster bolt that ricocheted from the floor and the canted face of the shield generator. Rushing onto the scene, the Spec 3 went hand-to-hand with the Merc Clymer had booted aside, but Clymer was out of tricks for dealing with the second assailant. Vibroblade clasped in 2 hands, the enemy fighter leapt. Shrine moved in a blur. Not for Clymer, because he knew that he could never reach him in time, but for the still-spinning lightsaber hilt, which he towed directly into Clymer's gloved and outstretched left hand. In the same instant, the Merc was leaning over Clymer to deliver what would have been a fatal blow. The commando's thumb hit the lightsaber's activation stud. A column of blue energy surged from the hilt and through the Separatist's chest, impaling him. Shrine hurried to Clymer's side, while the Spec 3 was moving through the room, making certain no further surprises awaited them.
Clymer rolled the mercenary's body to one side and sat up.
Thanks for the save, General.
Just didn't want you to end up like your template. Clymer stared at him. Headless, I mean. Clymer nodded.
I thought you meant killed by a Jedi.
Shrine held out his hand for the lightsaber, which Clymer was regarding as if noticing for the first time. Then, feeling Shrine's gaze on him, he said,
Sorry, sir.
And slapped the hilt into Shrine's hand. Shrine hooked the lightsaber to his belt and yanked Clymer to his feet, his eyes falling on Shattak, Starstone, and Ion Team's other two commandos, who'd rushed into the room with weapons drawn. Shrine gestured to them that everything was under control. Find any patience? He asked Shattak when she was within earshot. None, she said. But we hadn't checked out the entire building when we heard the blaster fire. Shrine turned to Clymer. Set your thermal charges. Then contact Commander Salvo. Tell him to alert Airborne Command that the landing platform energy shield will be dropping, but that someone is still going to have to take out the shore batteries on the bridge approaches before troops and artillery can be inserted. General Shattak and I will finish sweeping the building and catch up with you at the rally point.
Raz says you made a kill with General Shrine's lightsaber.
One of the commandos who'd accompanied Bol Shattak said to Clymer, while all four members of Ion Team were slaving thermal detonators to the shield generator's control panels.
That's right, and knowing that you'd want to see it, I had my helmet cam snap a hollow.
Clymer's sarcasm was lost on the small arms expert, a Spec 2 who went by the name Trace. Completing his task, Clymer walked with purpose through the control room, assessing everyone's work. Ion Team's comlink specialist hurried over while Clymer was adjusting the placement of one of the detonators.
Has Commander Salvo been updated?
Clymer asked.
The commander is on the Freak now,
the Spec 1 said.
Wants to speak to you personally.
Clymer distanced himself from the rest of the team and chinned the helmet comlink stud to an encrypted frequency.
Spec 0 Clymer, secure, Commander. Are the Jedi with you?
Salvo said abruptly.
No, sir. They're sweeping the rest of the building in case we overlooked anyone. What's your situation, squad leader? We're out of here as soon as the rest of the thermals are set. T5 at most. Retain a couple of those thermals. Your team is to rejoin us soonest. We have a revised priority. Revised? How? The Jedi are to be killed.
Clymer fell silent for a long moment.
Say again, Commander? We're taking out the Jedi. On whose orders? Are you questioning my authority? No, sir. Just doing my job. Your job is to obey your superiors.
Clymer recalled Shrine's actions in the generator room, his speed and accuracy, his skill with the lightsaber.
Yes, sir. I'm just not too keen about going up against three Jedi. None of us is, Clymer. That's why we need your team here. I want to set up an ambush short of the rally point. Understood, Commander. We'll comply. Out.
Clymer rejoined his three teammates, all of whom were watching him closely.
What was all that about?
Trace asked. Clymer sat on his haunches.
We've been ordered to spring an ambush on the Jedi.
Raz grunted.
Odd time for a live fire exercise, isn't it?
Clymer turned to him.
It's not an exercise.
Raz didn't move a muscle.
I thought the Jedi were on our side.
Clymer nodded.
So did I. So what'd they do?
Trace asked. Clymer shook his head.
Salvo didn't say, and it's not a question we're supposed to ask. Are we clear on that?
The three specs regarded one another.
How do you want to handle it?
Raz said finally.
The commander wants us to blow an ambush.
Clymer said in a determined voice.
I say we give him what he wants.
From the sheer heights above the med center, Shrine, Shattak, and Starstone watched the towering building tremble as the shield generator buried at its base exploded.
Clouds of smoke billowed into the chaotic sky, and the structure swayed precariously. Fortunately, it didn't collapse, as Shrine feared it might, so the bridges that spanned the bay suffered no damage. 10 kilometers away, the shimmering energy shield that umbrellaed the landing platform winked out and failed, leaving the huge hexagon open to attack. Not a moment passed before squadrons of Republic V-Wing starfighters and ARC 170 bombers fell from the scudding clouds, cannons blazing. In defense, anti-aircraft batteries on the landing field and bridges opened up, filling the sky with hyphens of raw energy. "Now it begins in earnest," Shrine said. The three Jedi struck west, moving deeper into the city, then south, angling for the rendezvous point. They avoided engagements with battle droids and mercenaries when they could, and won their skirmishes when evasion wasn't an option. Shrine was relieved to see that Shatak's curly-haired Padawan demonstrated remarkable courage, and was as deft at handling a lightsaber as many full-fledged Jedi knights. He suspected that she had a stronger connection with the Force than he had had, even during his most stalwart years as an eager learner. The fighting along the shoreline was becoming ferocious. Starfighters and droid craft flying well below optimum altitudes were disappearing in balls of flame. Overwhelmed by ranged ion cannon fire from the Gallant, energy shields throughout the city were beginning to fail, and a mass exodus was underway, with panicked crowds of Korovar fleeing shelters, homes, and places of business. Mercenary brigades, reinforced by battle droids and tanks, were fortifying their positions in the hills. Shrine surmised that the fight to occupy Mirkana was going to be long and brutal, perhaps at an unprecedented cost in lives. 200 meters shy of the rendezvous, he was shaken by a sudden restiveness that had nothing to do with the overarching battle. Feeling as if he'd unwittingly led his fellow Jedi into the sights of enemy snipers, he motioned Shatak and Starstone to a halt, then guided them without explanation to the refuge of a deserted storefront. "I thought I was the only one sensing it," Shatak said quietly. Shrine wasn't surprised. Like Starstone, the Zabrak Jedi had a deep and abiding connection to the Force. "Can you get to the heart of it?" he asked. She shook her head no. "Not with any clarity." Starstone cut her eyes from one Jedi to the other. "What's wrong? I don't sense anything." "Exactly," Shrine said. "We're close to the rendezvous, Padawan," Shatak said in her best mentor's voice. "So where is everyone? Why haven't the troopers set up a perimeter?" Starstone mulled it over.
"Maybe they're just waiting for us to arrive."
The young woman's offhand remark went to the core of what Shrine and Shatak were feeling. Trading alert glances, they unclipped their lightsabers and activated the blades.
"Be mindful, Padawan," Shatak cautioned as they were leaving the shelter of the storefront. "Stretch out with your feelings."
Farther on, at a confluence of twisting streets, Shrine perceived Commander Salvo and a platoon of troopers dispersed in a tight semicircle. Not, however, to provide the Jedi with cover fire in case they were being pursued. Shrine's earlier sense of misgiving blossomed into alarm, and he shouted for Shatak and Starstone to drop to the ground. They no sooner did when a series of concussive detonations shook the street, but the blasts had been shaped to blow at Salvo's position rather than at the Jedi. Shrine grasped instantly that the flameless explosions had been produced by ECDs, electrostatic charge detonators. Used to disable droids, an ECD was a tactical version of the magnetic pulse weapon the gunships had released on reaching the beach. Caught in the detonator's indiscriminate blast radius, Salvo and his troopers yelled in surprise as their helmet imaging systems and weapons responded to the surge by going offline. Momentarily blinded by light flare from heads-up displays, the troopers struggled to remove their helmets and simultaneously reach for the combat knives strapped to their belts. By then, though, Captain Clymer and the rest of Ion Team had rushed into the open from where they'd been hiding, two of the commandos already racing toward the temporarily blinded troopers.
"Gather weapons,"
Clymer instructed.
No firing!
Blaster in hand and helmet under one arm, Clymer advanced slowly on the three Jedi.
No mind tricks, General,
he warned. Shrine wasn't certain that the Jedi technique was even included in his repertoire any longer, but he kept that to himself. What's this about, Clymer?
We received orders to kill you.
Shrine stared at him in disbelief. Who issued the order? Clymer gave his jaw a flick, as if to indicate something behind him.
You'll have to ask Commander Salvo, sir.
Clymer! Where are you?
Salvo shouted, as Clymer's Spec 2 was escorting the commander forward. The commander's helmet was off, and he had his gloved hands pressed to his eyes.
You blew those ECDs?
We did, sir. To get to the bottom of this.
Sensing Shrine's approach, Salvo raised his armored fists. At ease, Commander, Shrine told him. Salvo relaxed somewhat.
Are we your prisoners, then?
You gave the order to kill us?
I won't answer that, Salvo said.
Commander, if this has anything to do with our earlier headbutting...
Don't flatter yourself, General. This is beyond both of us.
Shrine was confused. Then the order didn't originate with you? Did you ask for verification? Salvo shook his head no.
That wasn't necessary.
Clymer?
Shrine said.
I don't know any more than you know, General. And I doubt that Commander Salvo will be as easily persuaded to part with information as our captive Merc was. General Shrine,
the Spec One interrupted, tapping his forefinger against the side of his helmet.
Comlink from forward operations. Additional platoons are on their way to Auric Bacta to reinforce.
Clymer looked Shrine in the eye.
Sir, we're not going to be able to stop all of them. And if it comes to a fight, we're not going to be able to help you any more than we have. We don't kill our own.
I understand, Clymer.
This has to be a mistake, sir.
I agree.
For old time's sake, I'm giving you a chance to escape. But orders are orders. If we find you, we will engage.
Shrine knew Mirkana City by heart.
This way. Down here. Up there,
he instructed, as they made their escape, using the speed granted by the Force to put kilometers between themselves and their new enemy. The city was wide open to bombardment now. The energy shields were down, and the anti-laser aerosols had diffused. In the streets, firefights were undergoing a conspicuous change, now that the clone troopers had been issued a new priority. Separatist mercenaries and battle droids were making the most of the confusion. Shrine, Shatak, and Starstone had witnessed several instances when platoons of clones disengaged from fighting, presumably to continue the hunt for the Jedi. When Shrine felt that the three of them had a moment to spare, he led them into a deserted building and pulled his comlink from his belt. The troopers have changed frequencies to prevent our eavesdropping on them, he said. That doesn't affect our knowing their methods for conducting a search, Shatak said.
We can avoid them for however long it takes to clear this up. If it comes down to worst cases, I have contacts in the city who might be able to help us escape.
Whose lives are we protecting here?
Starstone asked in an edgy voice.
Ours or the troopers? I mean, aren't we the ones who had them grown?
Shrine and Shatak traded secret glances.
I'm not going to start killing troopers, Shrine said emphatically.
Shatak glanced at her Padawan.
That's what battle droids were created for.
Starstone gnawed at her lower lip.
What about Master Lorne and the others?
Shrine made adjustments to his comlink.
Still no response from any of them, and not because of signal jamming.
Knowing that Shatak was doing the same, he stretched out with the Force, but no reverberations attended his call. Shatak's shoulders slumped.
They've been killed.
Starstone sighed and hung her head.
Draw on your training, Padawan, Shatak said quickly. They're with the Force.
They're dead, Shrine thought. Starstone looked up at him.
Why have they turned on us?
Salvo implied that the order came from high up.
That can only mean
the office of the Supreme Chancellor, Shatak said. Shrine shook his head.
That doesn't make sense. Palpatine owes his life to Skywalker and Master Kenobi.
Then this has to be a miscommunication, Starstone chimed in.
For all we know, the Corporate Alliance broke the High Command Code and issued counterfeit orders to our company commanders.
Right about now, that would be a best-case scenario, Shrine said. If our comm links were powerful enough to contact the Temple.
But the Temple can contact us, Starstone said.
And it might yet, Shatak said. Patience, Padawan.
Shrine slipped the comm link back into its pouch.
We need to avoid further engagements with droids or mercenaries. Lightsaber wounds are easy to identify. We don't want to leave a trail.
Exiting the building, they resumed their careful climb into the hills. Everywhere they turned, the streets were crowded with clone troopers, battle droids, and masses of fleeing Korovar. Before they'd gone even a kilometer, Shrine brought them to a halt once more.
We're getting nowhere fast. If we ditch our robes, we might have better luck at blending in.
Shatak regarded him dubiously.
What do you have in mind, Roan?
We find a couple of mercenaries and take their robes and headcloths.
He gazed at Shatak and Starstone in turn.
If the troopers can switch sides, then so can we.
Salvo ended his helmet comlink communication with Mirkana's theater commanders and joined Clymer at what had become the troopers' forward command base. The other three commandos were searching for the escaped Jedi, but Salvo didn't want the squad leader out of his sight.
General Lorne and the two Jedi Knights he arrived with were ambushed and killed,
Salvo shared with Clymer.
Apparently no troopers among the 22nd staked a claim to the moral high ground.
Clymer let the remark go.
Did you report our actions to High Command?
Salvo shook his head.
But don't think I won't. Like I told you, it depends on whether we're able to kill them. I don't want your actions reflecting negatively on my command. Did you learn anything about what prompted the execution order?
Salvo spent a moment arguing with himself about what he should and should not reveal.
Theater Command reports that four Jedi Masters attempted to assassinate Supreme Chancellor Palpatine in his chambers on Coruscant. The reason is unclear, but it appears that the Jedi have been angling from the start to assume control of the Republic, and that the war may have been engineered to help bring that about.
Clymer was stunned.
So Palpatine's order was put in place because he anticipated that the Jedi might try something? It's not unusual to have a contingency plan, Clymer. You should know that better than anyone.
Eat, Shrine said, forcing some of the rations he'd taken from his utility belt on a distracted Olee Starstone.
We don't know when we'll have another chance.
Several hours had passed since they had fled the ambush site, and they'd traveled clear across the city to an empty warehouse close to the access ramps of the northernmost of the landing platform bridges. It was midnight, and they were attired in the garb of three mercenaries they'd taken by surprise behind the Argente Tower. Shrine continued.
There may come a point when we'll have to get rid of our comlinks, beacon transceivers, and lightsabers. Being taken prisoner could be our way off, Mirkana.
Shrine had a ration pack lifted to his mouth when his beacon transceiver began to vibrate. He fished the device from the deep pocket of the Korovar robe and regarded it in silence.
Could be troopers, tapping into our frequencies, Shatak said.
Shrine studied the beacon's small display screen.
It's a coded burst transmission from the temple.
Shatak hurried to his side to peer over his shoulder.
Can you decipher it?
It's not a simple 913, Shrine said, referring to the code the Jedi used to locate one another in emergency situations. Give me a moment.
When the burst transmission began to recycle, he turned to Shatak in stark incredulity.
The High Council is ordering all Jedi back to Coruscant.
Shatak was dumbfounded.
No explanation, Shrine said.
Shatak stood up and paced away from him.
What could have happened?
Shrine thought about it.
A follow-up attack on Coruscant by Grievous?
Perhaps, Shatak said.
But that doesn't account for the clone troopers' disloyalty.
Maybe there's been a universal clone trooper revolt, Starstone suggested. The Kaminoans could have betrayed us. All these years, they could have been in league with Count Dooku. They could have programmed the troopers to revolt at a predetermined time.
Shrine was glancing at Shattuck. Does she ever stop? I haven't been able to find the off switch. Shrine moved to the nearest window and watched the night sky. Republic starfighters will be setting down on the landing platform by late morning, he said. Shattuck joined him at the window. Then Morkana is won. Shrine turned to face her. We have to reach the platform. The troopers have their orders, and now we have ours. If we can seize a transport or starfighters, we may yet be able to return to Coruscant. With night falling, the Jedi wove through firefights and fountaining explosions, using their captured blasters, rather than their lightsabers, to defend themselves against teams of clone troopers and commandos, though without killing any. They came to a halt at a ruined stretch of permacrete, at the far end of which a squadron of starfighters was touching down. Can you pilot a ship? Shrine asked Starstone in a rush. Only an interceptor, Master. But without an astromech droid, I doubt I could fly one to Coruscant. And I've never even seen the cockpit of a V-Wing. Shrine considered it. Then it'll have to be an ARC 170. He pointed to a bomber that was just landing, probably to refuel. That's our ship. Shattuck watched the crew for a moment. We may have to stun the co-pilot and tail gunner. Shrine was on the verge of moving when he felt the beacon transceiver vibrate again, and he pawed it from the deep pocket of the robe. What is it, Roan? Shattuck asked while he was staring in stupefaction at the device. Another coded burst from the beacon, he said, without moving his gaze from the screen. Same order? The opposite. Eyes wide, he looked up at Shattuck and Starstone. All Jedi are ordered to avoid Coruscant at all costs. We're to abandon whatever missions we're involved in and go into hiding. Shattuck's mouth fell open. Shrine made his lips a thin line. We still need to get off Murkana. They double-checked their blasters, and again were on the verge of setting out for the starfighter, when every Separatist droid and war machine on the landing platform abruptly began to power down. At first, Shrine thought that another droid buster had been delivered without his being aware of it. Then he realized his mistake. This was something different. The droids hadn't simply been dazzled. They had been deactivated. Even the hailfires and tanks. Red photoreceptors lost their glow. Alloy limbs and antennas relaxed. Every soldier and war machine stood motionless. At once, a full wing of gunships dropped out of the noon sky, releasing almost 1,000 clone troopers riding polyplast cables to the platform's ruined surface. Shrine, Shattuck, and Starstone watched helplessly as they were almost instantly surrounded. Capture is infinitely preferable to execution, Shrine said. It could still be our way out. Closest to the ragged edge of the platform, he allowed his blaster, comlink, beacon transceiver, and lightsaber to slip from his hands into the dark waters far below. Part 2. The Emperor's Emissary. The Star Destroyer Exactor, second in a line of newly minted Imperator-class naval vessels, emerged from hyperspace and inserted into orbit, its spiked bow aimed at the former separatist world of Murkana. At 1,600 meters in length, the Exactor, unlike its Venator-class predecessors, was a product of quad drive yards and featured gaping ventral launching bays rather than a dorsal flight deck. In his quarters aboard the capital ship, now under his personal command, Darth Vader, gloved and artificial right hand clamped on the hilt of his new lightsaber, knelt before a larger-than-life hologram of Emperor Palpatine. Only 4 standard weeks had elapsed since the war had ended, and Palpatine had proclaimed himself Emperor of the former Republic, to the adulation of the leaders of countless worlds that had been drawn into the protracted conflict, and to the sustained acclaim of nearly the entire Senate. Palpatine wore a voluminous embroidered robe of rich weave, the cowl of which was raised, concealing in shadow,
the scars he'd suffered at the hands of the four treasonous Jedi Masters who'd attempted to arrest him in his chambers in the Senate office building, as well as other deformations resulting from his fierce battle with Master Yoda in the rotunda of the Senate itself.
"This is an important time for you, Lord Vader,"
Palpatine was saying.
"You are finally free to make full use of your powers. If not for us, the galaxy would never have been restored to order. Now you must embrace the sacrifices you made to bring this about and revel in the fact that you have fulfilled your destiny. It can all be yours, my young apprentice. Anything you wish. You need only have the determination to take it, at whatever cost to those who stand in your way."
Palpatine's disfigurements were really nothing new, nor was his deliberate, vaguely contemptuous voice. The Emperor had used the same voice to procure his first apprentice, to ensnare Trade Federation Viceroy Newt Gunray in facilitating his dark designs, to persuade Count Dooku to unleash a war, and finally, to seduce Vader, former Jedi Knight Anakin Skywalker, to the dark side, with the promise that he could keep Anakin's wife from dying. Few among the galaxy's trillions were aware that Palpatine was also a Sith Lord, known by the title Darth Sidious, or that he had manipulated the war in order to bring down the Republic, crush the Jedi, and place the entire galaxy under his full control. Fewer still knew of the crucial role Sidious's current apprentice had played in those events, having helped Sidious defend himself against the Jedi who'd sought his arrest, having led the assault on the Jedi Temple on Coruscant, having killed in cold blood the half-dozen members of the Separatist Council in their hidden fortress on volcanic Mustafar. And who there had suffered even more gravely than Palpatine? Down on one knee, his black-masked face raised to the hologram, tall, fearsome Vader was wearing the bodysuit and armor, helmet, boots, and cloak that both camouflaged the evidence of his transformation and sustained his life. Without revealing his distress at being unable to maintain the kneeling posture, Vader said,
"What are your orders, Master?"
And asked himself, "Is this poorly designed suit the source of my distress, or is something else at work?"
"Word has reached me that a group of clone troopers on Mercana may have deliberately refused to comply with Order 66.
Vader tightened his hold on the lightsaber.
"I had not heard, Master."
He knew that Order 66 had not been hardwired into the clones by the Kaminoans who had grown them. Rather, the troopers, the commanders especially, had been programmed to demonstrate unfailing loyalty to the Supreme Chancellor in his role as Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic. And so when the Jedi had revealed their seditious plans, they had become a threat to Palpatine and had been sentenced to death. On myriad worlds, Order 66 had been executed without misfortune. On Mygeeto, Salukami, Felucia, and many others. Taken by surprise, thousands of Jedi had been assassinated by troopers who had for 3 years answered almost exclusively to them. A few Jedi were known to have escaped death by dint of superior skill or accident. But on Mercana, apparently unique events had played out. Events that were potentially more dangerous to the Empire than the few Jedi who'd survived.
"What was the cause of the troopers' insubordination, Master?"
Vader asked.
"Contagion,"
Palpatine sneered.
"Contagion brought about by fighting alongside the Jedi for so many years. Clone or otherwise, there is only so much a being can be programmed to do. Sooner or later, even a lowly trooper will become the sum of his experiences."
Light years distant in his inner sanctum, Palpatine leaned toward the holotransceiver's cam.
"But you will demonstrate to them the peril of independent thinking, Lord Vader. The refusal to obey orders."
"To obey you, Master?"
"To obey us, my apprentice. Remember that.
Yes, my master.
Vader paused with purpose.
It's possible, then, that some Jedi may have survived.
Palpatine adopted a look of consummate displeasure.
I am not worried about your pathetic former friends, Lord Vader. I want those clone troopers punished, as a reminder to all of them that for the rest of their abbreviated lives, they would do well to understand whom they truly serve.
Retracting his face into the hood of his robe, he said in a seething tone,
"It is time that you were revealed as my authority. I leave it to you to drive the point home."
Vader didn't rise until the Emperor's holo image had derezzed entirely. Then he stood for a long moment with his sheathed arms dangling at his sides, his head mournfully bowed. Finally, he turned and moved for the hatch that opened onto the Exactor's ready room. To the galaxy at large, Jedi Knight Anakin Skywalker, poster boy for the war effort, the hero with no fear, the Chosen One, had died on Coruscant during the siege of the Jedi Temple. And to some extent, that was true. "Anakin is dead," Vader told himself. And yet, if not for events on Mustafar, Anakin would sit now on the Coruscant throne, his wife by his side, their child in her arms. Instead, Palpatine's plan could not have been more flawlessly executed. He had won it all. The war. The Republic. The fealty of the one Jedi Knight in whom the entire Jedi Order had placed its hope. The revenge of the self-exiled Sith had been complete, and Darth Vader was merely a minion, an errand boy, allegedly an apprentice, the public face of the dark side of the Force. While he retained his knowledge of the Jedi arts, he felt uncertain about his place in the Force. And while he had taken his first steps toward awakening the power of the dark side, he felt uncertain about his ability to sustain that power. How far he might have been now, had fate not intervened to strip him of almost everything he possessed as a means of remaking him, or of humbling him, as Darth Maul and Darth Tyrannus had been humbled before him, as indeed the Jedi Order itself had been humbled. Where Darth Sidious had gained everything, Vader had lost everything, including, for the moment at least, the self-confidence and unbridled skill he had demonstrated as Anakin Skywalker. Vader turned and moved for the hatch. "But this is not walking," he thought. Long accustomed to building and rebuilding droids, supercharging the engines of landspeeders and starfighters, upgrading the mechanisms that controlled the first of his artificial limbs, he was dismayed by the incompetence of the medical droids responsible for his resurrection in Sidious's lofty laboratory on Coruscant. His alloy lower legs were bulked by strips of armor, similar to those that filled and gave form to the long glove Anakin had worn over his right arm prosthesis. What remained of his real limbs ended in bulbs of grafted flesh, inserted into machines that triggered movement through the use of modules that interfaced with his damaged nerve endings. But instead of using Durasteel, the medical droids had substituted an inferior alloy and had failed to inspect the strips that protected the electromotive lines. As a result, the inner lining of the pressurized bodysuit was continually snagging on places where the strips were anchored to knee and ankle joints. The tall boots were a poor fit for his artificial feet, whose claw-like toes lacked the electrostatic sensitivity of his equally false fingertips. Raised in the heel, the cumbersome footgear canted him slightly forward, forcing him to move with exaggerated caution, lest he stumble or topple over. Worse, they were so heavy that he often felt rooted to the ground, or as if he were moving in high gravity. What good was motion of this sort if he was going to have to call on the Force even to walk from place to place? He may as well have resigned himself to using a repulsor chair and abandoned any hope of movement. The defects in his prosthetic arms mirrored those of his legs. Only the right one felt natural to him, though it too was artificial, and the pneumatic mechanisms that supplied articulation and support were sometimes slow to respond. The weighty cloak
and pectoral plating so restricted his movement that he could scarcely lift his arms over his head, and he had already been forced to adapt his lightsaber technique to compensate. He could probably adjust the servo drivers and pistons in his forearms to provide his hands with strength enough to crush the hilt of his new lightsaber. With the power of his arms alone, he had the ability to lift an adult being off the ground. But the Force had always given him the ability to do that, especially in moments of rage, as he had demonstrated on Tatooine and elsewhere. What's more, the sleeves of the bodysuit didn't hug the prostheses as they should, and the elbow-length gloves sagged and bunched at his wrists. Gazing at the gloves now, he thought, "This is not seeing." The pressurized mask was goggle-eyed, fish-mouthed, short-snouted, and needlessly angular over the cheekbones. Coupled with a flaring dome of helmet, the mask gave him the forbidding appearance of an ancient Sith war droid. The dark hemispheres that covered his eyes filtered out light that might have caused further injury to his damaged corneas and retinas, but in enhanced mode, the half-globes reddened the light and prevented him from being able to see the toes of his boots without inclining his head almost 90 degrees. Listening to the servo motors that drove his limbs, he thought, "This is not hearing." The med droids rebuilt the cartilage of his outer ears, but his eardrums, having melted in Mustafar's heat, had been beyond repair. Sound waves now had to be transmitted directly to implants in his inner ear, and sounds registered as if issuing from underwater. Worse, the implanted sensors lacked sufficient discrimination, so that too many ambient sounds were picked up, and their distance and direction were difficult to determine. Sometimes the sensors needled him with feedback, or attached echo or vibrato effects to even the faintest noise. Allowing his lungs to fill with air, he thought, "This is not breathing." Here, the medroids had truly failed him. From a control box he wore strapped to his chest, a thick cable entered his torso, linking to a breathing apparatus and heartbeat regulator. The ventilator was implanted in his hideously scarred chest, along with tubes that ran directly into his damaged lungs and others that entered his throat, so that should the chest plate or belt control panels develop a glitch, he could breathe unassisted for a limited time. But the monitoring panel beeped frequently and for no reason, and the constellation of lights served only as steady reminders of his vulnerability. The incessant rasp of his breathing interfered with his ability to rest, let alone sleep. And sleep, in the rare moments it came to him, was a nightmarish jumble of twisted, recurrent memories that unfolded to excruciating sounds. The medroids had at least inserted the redundant breathing tubes low enough so that, with the aid of an enunciator, his scorched vocal cords could still form sounds and words. But absent the enunciator, which imparted a synthetic bass tone, his own voice was little more than a whisper. He could take food through his mouth as well, but only when he was inside a hyperbaric chamber, since he had to remove the triangular respiratory vent that was the mask's prominent feature. So it was easier to receive nourishment through liquids, intravenous and otherwise, and to rely on catheters, collection pouches, and recyclers to deal with liquid and solid waste. But all those devices made it even more difficult for him to move with ease, much less with any grace. The pectoral armor that protected the artificial lung weighed him down, as did the electrode-studded collar that supported the outsized helmet, necessary to safeguard the cybernetic devices that replaced the uppermost of his vertebrae, the delicate systems of the mask, and the ragged scars in his hairless head, which owed as much to what he had endured on Mustafar as to attempts at emergency trephination during the trip back to Coruscant aboard Sidious's shuttle. The synth skin that substituted for what was seared from his bones itched incessantly, and his body needed to be periodically cleansed and scrubbed of necrotic flesh. Already he had experienced moments of claustrophobia, moments of desperation to be rid of the suit, to emerge from the shell. He needed to build or have built a chamber in which he could feel human again, if possible. All in all, he thought, this is not living. This was solitary confinement, prison of the worst sort.
Continual torture. He was nothing more than wreckage. Power without clear purpose.
A melancholy sigh escaped the mouth grill. Collecting himself, he stepped through the hatch.
Commander Appa was waiting in the ready room. The special ops officer who had led the 501st Legion against the Jedi Temple.
Your shuttle is prepared, Lord Vader,
Appa said. For reasons that went beyond the armor and helmets, the imaging systems and boots, Vader felt more at home among the troopers than he did around other flesh and bloods. Vader looked down at Appa and nodded.
Come with me, Commander. The Emperor has business for us on Murkana.
Shine squinted against the golden wash of Murkana's primary, which had just climbed from behind the thickly forested hills that walled Murkana City to the east. By his reckoning, he had spent close to 4 weeks confined with hundreds of other captives to a windowless warehouse somewhere in the city. Hours earlier, all of them had been marched through the dark to a red clay landing field that had been notched into one of the hills and was currently swarming with Republic troops. On its hard stand sat a military transport Shrine surmised would deliver everyone to a proper prison on or in orbit around some forlorn outer rim world. Thus far, though, none of the prisoners had been ordered to board the transport. Instead, a headcount was being conducted. More important, the clone troopers were obviously waiting for someone or something to arrive. When his eyes had adjusted fully to the light, Shrine scanned the prisoners to all sides of him, relieved to find Bal Shatak and her Padawan standing some 50 meters away, among a mixed group of indigenous Korovar fighters and an assortment of Separatist mercenaries. He called to them through the Force, figuring that Shatak would be first to respond, but it was Starstone who turned slightly in his direction and smiled faintly. Then Shatak looked his way, offering a quick nod. On their capture at the landing platform, the three of them had been separated. The fact that Shatak had managed to retain her headcloth perhaps explained why her short cranial horns hadn't singled her out as a brack and raised an alert among her captors. Assuming that the conditions of her captivity had been similar to his, Shatak's being overlooked made perfect sense to Shrine. Rounded up with hundreds of enemy fighters, following the still puzzling deactivation of Murkana's battle droids and other war machines, Shrine had been searched, roughed up, and marched into the dark building that would become his home for the next 4 weeks, a special torment reserved for mercenaries. Any who hadn't willingly surrendered their weapons had been executed, and dozens more had died in fierce fights that had broken out for the few scraps of food that had been provided. It hadn't taken long for Shrine to grasp that winning the hearts and minds of Separatist fighters was no longer tops on Chancellor Palpatine's list. It also hadn't taken long for him to give up worrying about being found out, since he'd been placed in the custody of low-ranking clone troopers, whose armor blazes identified them as members of companies other than Commander Salvo's. The troopers had rarely spoken to any of the prisoners, so there'd been no news of the war or of events that might have prompted the High Council to order the Jedi to go into hiding. Shrine knew only that the fighting on Murkana had stopped and that the Republic had triumphed. He was considering the advantage of edging himself closer to where Shatak and Starstone stood when a convoy of military speeders and big-wheeled juggernauts arrived on the scene. Commander Salvo and some of his chief officers stepped from one of the land speeders. From the hatch of one of the juggernauts emerged Commando Squad Leader Climber and the rest of Ion Team. Shrine wondered about the timing of the commander's arrival. Perhaps Salvo was determined to have a close look at each and every prisoner before any were loaded into the transport. That Shrine was farther back from the leading edge of the crowd than Shatak and Starstone were meant nothing. Given the amount of time they'd spent with Salvo, he would have no trouble identifying all of them. Oddly, though, the commander wasn't paying much attention to the prisoners. His T-visor gaze was fixed instead on a Republic shuttle that was descending toward the landing field. Theta class, one of the prisoners said quietly to the mercenary standing alongside him.
You don't see many of those,
the second human said.
Must be one of Palpatine's regional governors.
The shuttle had commenced its landing sequence.
With ion drive powering down and repulsor lift engaged, the craft folded its long wings upward to provide access to the main hold, then settled gently to the ground. No sooner had the boarding ramp extended than a squad of elite troopers filed out, the red markings on their armor identifying them as Coruscant shock troopers. A much taller figure followed, attired head to foot in black.
What in the moons of Bogdan? New breed of trooper? Only if someone furnished the cloners with a donor a lot taller than the original.
Salvo and his officers hastened over to the figure in black.
Welcome, Lord Vader.
Vader?
The merc closest to Shrine said.
Lord, Shrine thought. That's no clone,
the first human said. Shrine didn't know what to make of Vader, although it was evident from the reaction of Salvo and his officers that they'd been told to expect someone of high rank. With his large helmet and flowing black cape, Vader looked like something borrowed from the Separatists, a grotesque, grievous-like marriage of humanoid and machine. Salvo was gesturing to Clymer and the other commandos who'd remained at the Juggernaut. From inside the enormous vehicle floated a large anti-grav capsule with a transparent lid, which two of the commandos began to guide toward Vader's shuttle. As the capsule passed close to Shrine, he caught a glimpse of brown robes, and his stomach lurched into his throat. When the capsule finally reached Salvo, the commander opened an access panel in its base and removed three gleaming cylinders, which he proffered to Vader.
Lightsabers.
Vader nodded for the commander of his shock troopers to accept them. Then, in a deep, synthesized voice, said to Salvo,
What were you saving the bodies for, Commander? Posterity?
Salvo shook his head.
We weren't issued any instructions.
Vader's gloved hand waved him silent.
Dispose of them in any fashion you see fit.
Salvo was motioning Clymer to remove the anti-grav coffin when Vader stopped him.
Have you forgotten anyone, Commander?
Salvo regarded him.
Forgotten, Lord Vader?
Vader folded his arms across his massive chest.
6 Jedi were assigned to Mercana, not 3.
Shrine traded brief glances with Shatak, who was also close enough to Vader to hear the remark.
I'm sorry to report, Lord Vader, that the other 3 evaded capture.
Salvo said. Vader nodded.
I already know that, Commander. And I haven't come halfway across the galaxy to chase them down.
He drew himself erect with a haughty air.
I've come to deal with the ones who allowed them to escape.
Clymer immediately stepped forward.
That would be me. And us,
the rest of Ion team announced in unison. Vader stared down at the commandos.
You disobeyed a direct order from High Command.
The order made no sense at the time.
Clymer answered for everyone.
We thought it might be a Separatist trick.
What you thought has no bearing on this,
Vader said, pointing at Clymer.
You are expected to follow orders.
And we follow any reasonable ones. Killing our own didn't qualify.
Vader continued to point his forefinger at Clymer's chest.
They weren't your allies, squad leader. They were traitors, and you sided with them.
Clymer stood his ground.
Traitors how? Because a few of them tried to arrest Palpatine. I still don't see how that warrants a death penalty for the lot of them.
I'll be sure to notify the Emperor of your concerns.
You do that.
Shrine closed his mouth and swallowed hard. Jedi had tried to arrest Palpatine. The Republic now had an Emperor.
Unfortunately, you won't be alive to learn of his response.
In one swift motion, he drew aside his cloak and pulled the lightsaber from his belt. Igniting with a snap hiss, the hilt projected a crimson blade. If Shrine had been confused earlier, he was now overwhelmed. A Sith blade? The 4 commandos fell back, raising their weapons.
We'll accept execution for our actions,
Clymer said.
But not from some lapdog of the Emperor.
Quickly, Salvo and his officers stepped forward, but Vader only showed them the palm of his hand.
No, Commander. Leave this to me.
With that, he moved on the commandos. Spreading out, they fired, but not a single bolt made it past Vader's blade. Deflected bolts went straight through the helmet visors of two of the commandos, and in two furious sweeps, Vader opened the pair from shoulder to hip, as if they were flimsy ration containers. Climber and the third commando took advantage of the moment to break for the nearby tree line, firing as they fled. A deflection shot from Vader caught Climber in the left leg, but the bolt didn't so much as slow him down. Vader tracked them, then motioned to his cadre of troopers.
I want them alive, Commander Apo.
Yes, Lord Vader.